This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Mike O'Neill here today, flying solo, no Mike Russell. Two very, very special guests, Sidney Rittenberg and his wife, Yulin Rittenberg, have a fascinating life story. My candidate for, now that, especially since this guy is retiring, for most interesting person in the world. Sidney was an American who was sent to China by the United States Army and lived in China from 1944 until 1979. He comes from a middle-class Jewish family from Charleston, South Carolina, and interestingly managed to acquaint himself with, among others, Mao Zedong and Chou Enlai, and Xi Jinping, the father of Xi Jinping, the current president of China. He's now a consultant to major U.S. corporations and the likes of Henry Kissinger, among other. And he does have a part-year resident in the Valley, which is how we were able to snag him. So welcome to the show, Sidney and Yulin.
Glad to be here, Mike.
Fascinating story. Tell us how you ended up in China.
Well, I really went to China in order not to go to Japan. In World War II, I was picked out of the infantry, sent to Stanford to be trained in Japanese for military government after the war. And I didn't want to be in military government, and I didn't want to be stuck overseas after the war. I wanted to come right home. China was an ally, so I talked myself out of Japanese into Chinese. Worked like a charm. In only 35 years, I was back home.
Yeah, it took a while. So post-World War II, we need a little history lesson. We got to make this sort of so everybody gets it. There's a power struggle in China between the nationalists and the communists.
Right, a civil war.
So you ended up hooked up with Mao and the communist, what was then an insurgency.
Right.
How'd that happen?
Well, you know, the difference between the two sides in China at that time was like nights and day. The communists were mainly in the villages with the peasants, squeaky clean and very close to the people and very puritanical.
Squeaky clean in what sense?
No corruption. Mm-hmm. The leaders ate the same thing that local people ate and lived very clean lives, in stark contrast to the nationalists who were terribly corrupt and really out of touch with their own people. So it wasn't just me. Most of the GIs who were in China at the time naturally sympathized with the communists.
Which is probably jarring to the ears of most of our audience.
I'm sure it is. And, of course, I thought that the China of the future, the communist-led China, would also be squeaky clean and close to the people and so on, which it wasn't.
That evolved over time. By the way, on the subject of squeaky clean, later on I'm going to ask you, Lynn, in her book, there's a really fascinating anecdote about how she encountered first the Japanese army and then the nationalist army and finally the communist insurgency. And that's just teasing. We will get to that in the next segment. But it really made your point in a very vivid way at a ground level. So 1949... there's an insurgency, and eventually the communists come to power. And you're close to leadership. You know them, but yet find yourself imprisoned.
Yeah. If I hadn't been close to leadership, I wouldn't have gone to prison. Mm-hmm. You know, what happened was that we were in the mountains. It was Beijing, the capital, was under siege. But not yet taken. We were in the mountains, and Stalin sent a message to Mao that I was an imperialist spy, demanded that I be arrested. And so I was arrested.
Now, you know that this came personally from Stalin?
We have documentary proof now, because a Russian scholar dug up the information out of the old Soviet archives. Mm-hmm. It actually has a copy of the cable that's back and forth between Stalin and Mao. And this is being published by the Woodrow Wilson Institute in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty certain. I didn't know at the time why I was being arrested, but I know now.
That's one of the beauties of a real legal system. You get to find out why you're there.
That's right.
But you must have figured out you'd fallen out of disfavor with somebody. Yeah, and Stalin was a major ally to how significant? He was a fairly significant ally to Mao, was he not?
Well, it's a mixed up story. Mao actually fought against Stalin to become the leader of the Chinese Party. He was not Stalin's candidate. Uh-huh. And Mao disapproved of Stalin's idea of how the Chinese should run their revolution. But this was all secret. On the surface, they were brother communists, and Stalin actually did give Mao some aid. Some financial aid, not a whole lot, but some.
Which we'll get into later, but yep. they around 1960, they started asking for payback.
And right.
I got that also out of Yulin's book. Now, what was the basis of the Stalin-Mao? What did Mao not like about the Stalin system?
Well, Mao's idea was that in China, the basic force in the revolution was not the working class, but the peasantry, who were dirt poor, mm-hmm. and very seriously oppressed. And Stalin thought this is not orthodox Marxism. You have to depend on the industrial working class, which in China was important, but it was tiny. And anything you tried to do openly in the cities would immediately be suppressed. So he could only exist and grow really in the villages.
So You're in prison now. I'm wondering, were you aware at all? And this, I'm struck in reading about that. You're imprisoned, and this is roughly contemporaneous with the Red Scare in the United States.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that at all?
Yeah, because I read the official communist newspaper was given to me in prison. Mm-hmm. At first, I got it 2 months late. Mm-hmm. So I used to look at the weather report to see how cold I had been 2 months before. But, yeah, I could get the news. When Watergate occurred and Nixon resigned, there was about a three-line note in the Chinese newspaper that the Watergate incident had resulted in Nixon's resignation. I had no idea the two words in Chinese, water and gate, I had no idea what it meant.
What?
So I guess that Nixon got his hand caught in the till for some hydropower program. I didn't know what it was.
Okay. So Stalin dies and you're released.
Stalin died, the only really good thing he ever did, and I was released.
Okay. We will pick this story up briefly with your story, and then we'll switch to Yulin. Okay. In just a minute. We will be back in the Think Tank on KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with Sydney and Yulin Rittenberg. We're going to go to Yulin in just a second, but I want to set up her discussion by asking you, okay, you're released from prison. From 1955 to 1968, what did you do?
I went back to work at Radio Peking.
Okay, and that's where you met?
That's where we met.
Okay, we're going to backtrack now. We're now in the 30s or 40s. Yulin, author of a book I'm partway through, After the Bitter Comes the Sweet, which it's not hard to figure out where that title comes from. You were born into a very poor peasant family in Western China. Is that right?
Yes, but not a peasant. It's a worker's family.
Okay, worker's family. And there's a really wonderful section in your book that I thought described a lot, where you talk about how you encountered the Japanese soldiers and then the nationalist soldiers and finally the communists. Could you describe what those encounters were like?
Okay. When Japanese came to China, at that time I was very small. I'm only 4 years old. And later on, expert Japanese soldiers raped my sister. Mm-hmm. That making me...
Raped your sister.
Yeah. My second sister, she is pretty, and then she was raped. After that, she was sick. So after that...
And I think from your book, this wasn't a random occurrence. This was widespread.
Yeah, it came from the book. Right. Then after that, because of Japanese invaders came to Beijing, the whole family moved to Hebei, Shijiazhuang. And then after that, I became a little kid. Pick up all the overcooked coal along the railway station. And then after that, and then the Communist Party came in 1947. And then after that, I'm so happy because I have time to go to school and without a pain. And they pay everything, your living condition, your food, your education. That make me so happy.
Well, what I remember you're describing in the Japanese were horrific. The nationalists came and they took what little food was left from your village. The communists came and they gave food rather than taking it. And I remember you describing also that they treated the people with respect.
Yeah, that's right. They treated people equally, especially the poor people. They called the peasants, workers, should be united. Mm-hmm. And they have a job, they always gave the poor people. Okay. So they really treated us very good. We called them because I was in middle school, then I called Uncle Andy. They called the ordinary people, the older, they call them uncle and sisters. It's a really polite. Mm-hmm. It's really polite. Completely different.
Mm-hmm. And you basically got education that was otherwise.
That's right.
So how did you end up in radio broadcasting in Beijing?
Well, that time, everything according to the leaders. That means the communist authorities, they ask you to go where you just go without talking. Uh-huh. So they gave me a job to radio. So that time I only 17 years old. Start then, I never leave the radio.
That must have been a pretty exciting place to be.
Well, it's good. I enjoy it. First, we go to the countryside. Uh-huh. It's a Kulungfeng. This is a really... not so many people there. Mm-hmm. This is we have a station. That's the central committee that is prepared because they started as a radio in Beijing. Mm-hmm. But if something happened, means that time, if a Kuomintang or something happened, then we have another station in the countryside.
Uh-huh. So what you think of how'd you meet this white American guy?
Well, I met this Sidney Rittenberg, so when he just came out from prison the second time, the first time. And then he can speak, but not fluently. He has nothing. So my leaders tell me, make an arrangement. Let him sit down, have a room, know how to go, how to buy things. So I'm in charge of this, daily life use. So I bought everything for him.
Resettlement officer.
Yes.
So fast forward, you get married, the second time he's in prison, tell me what happened to you. By this time, you have children, young children?
Yeah. Suddenly at midnight, he was away. But before that, we discussed. Mm-hmm. And then after he left, after 10 minutes, and the policeman came to me. So said, you don't live here anymore. You go somewhere. So with four kids, myself, and we are shut up in a special room for 10 months. So
sort of house arrest kind of situation?
Yeah, it's like a house arrest. Mm-hmm. You cannot go anywhere. They bring food, three meals a day. Especially have difficulties because for so long, we are not allowed to go out. Even you cannot open the windows to have some fresh air. So the kids, after one another, sick. So that's I have to talk to them, quarrel with them, led us to have doctors. Mm-hmm. So then it's later on they led doctors to see doctors.
You know, I want to ask about something. I ask about this because I think this would be jarring to most Americans to hear. But the support that the communists had, especially among working and peasantry, your mother in particular you wrote about.
Yeah.
Saying that everybody, your mom as a good example, described socialism as better than, quote, the old ways.
Well, the question is a different period. And Chinese started as a cultural revolution. The whole country is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I think a fair point.
Yeah.
I mean, the picture I get is something that started out from idealistic notions where people were better treated. And the Cultural Revolution was sort of like an instance of the whole country going crazy. Yeah, some of that was provoked, wasn't it? We alluded this briefly. The Russians wanted money repaid from the Korean War, and then basically contributed to a famine.
That's right. Mm-hmm. When Russia pushed China to pay the money, at that time I was in the school.
Okay, we'll be back. We're in the think tank with Sydney and Yulin Rettenberg.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with Sydney and Yulin Rittenberg. And by one construction, the man who stayed behind, that was post-World War II, stayed behind in China, became associated with, frankly, all the major leaders of the Communist Party of China. And he's an American from South Carolina, has been back in this country since 1980. I want to ask you some big, broader kind of philosophical questions, Sydney. Mao, the impression I get, and I get this from reading Yulin's book as well, that the behavior of the communist in the early years was very idealistic. It mm-hmm. was, you know, soldiers sacrifice themselves, they give to the people, But you think of the Cultural Revolution and you think of the latter years, and in the sense you get is this was an idealist who got corrupted by power over the long haul. Is that a fair statement?
I think it is. I think it is. You know, it's strange. Mao talked and preached and wrote incessantly about the dangers of the arrogance of power. Mm-hmm. And he made all his functionaries study this issue, but he suffered from the arrogance of power, mm-hmm. I think, more than perhaps anybody else in history.
Perhaps because he had more absolute power than just about anybody.
Yes.
There was a fascinating reference that you made. Early on, Mao is in the process or had just taken power, and you're aware of two messages to Harry Truman. Want to tell us about those?
Yes. He sent two messages, both of which I interpreted, to American representatives. One to a military representative, General Marshall's adjutant, and the other to a consul at the Consulate General in Beijing, the American. Mm-hmm. Message was the same. It was... Now, this was 1946.
Okay. Before they'd taken power.
3 years before they took power. Mm-hmm. And the message was, in 5 years, we are going to be in power in China. Actually, it didn't take five years. And when we do, we want to have normal relations with the United States. We know that you're helping Chiang Kai-shek to fight us. We expect this. That's okay. But once we're in power, we want to have normal relations for two reasons. The first reason was not surprising. He said, our country has been at war one way or another for over a century. the country is a heap of ruins, and we're going to need major loans to rebuild our country. And only the United States has that kind of money. And he said, we have gold. We're not asking for a handout. We can pay at the ongoing rates of interest. The second question really surprised me. He said, the second reason is, after we come to power, we do not want to be unilaterally dependent on the Soviet Union, that they're communists, we're communists, we have fraternal parties, but we have our own viewpoint on many issues, not the same as their viewpoint. And so we want to be able to deal with both the East and the West, both America and the Soviet Union.
And this is a staggeringly different picture from the picture that had been presented in the United States at the time. I remember I was a young kid for a lot of this, but the picture that we had painted was that there was a monolithic thing called communism and that they were all in on it together.
Nothing could be further than from the truth.
And you saw these messages yourself.
Yeah, I translated them. Okay. For the American representatives. And a real tragedy is that we ignored both of these messages.
Truman ignored.
I think it was largely Dean Rusk, mm-hmm. who was in charge of Asia mm-hmm. for the State Department.
Subsequently became Secretary of State under Kennedy.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think Rusk was a man of very strong principle, mm-hmm. but his principles were very dogmatic, and he couldn't see anything but a communist is a communist is a communist. Mm-hmm. Russian, Chinese, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think we made the same mistake in our views of Vietnam.
We did. You
know, we thought Vietnam, they're in it with the Chinese, ignoring yeah. maybe 1,000 years of
yeah. enmity. Yeah, yeah. So it was really tragic because I think if we had responded to Mao's advances, we might not have fought either the Korean War or the Vietnam War.
And that's just staggering how different our history would be. I'd like you, the current president of China, Xi Jinping, you knew his dad. You knew him. I believe when he traveled to Seattle, he went over to see you.
Well, we went to see
him. You went to see yeah. him. Okay. That's a point of protocol.
Yeah.
What are your impressions of him?
Both of our impressions are we like this guy. Mm-hmm. He's a straight shooter. He has a record as a local leader of not being mean to his opponents, of being easily approachable. But now we're seeing a great concentration of power in the hands of one man, which is, I think they're doing it because in order to carry out the economic reforms that he wants to do, he has to break through a tremendous amount of bureaucratic opposition. And in order to do that, he needs to be a powerful authoritarian figure. I think that's their thinking.
To break the back of a system whereby you have – and these right. are essentially in the direction of free market economy?
Yeah. His main purpose, as he stated, is to get the Chinese government out of business and to convert the government from a managing government to a service government. Nothing to do with business. Business should be operated under the laws of supply and demand. Mm-hmm. But –
That sounds like the end of communism.
Well, never mind labels, mm-hmm.
But labels matter. I mean, we react to labels, and people who don't know better can't get past a label.
We tell our friends in Beijing, we have more socialism in the United States than they have in China. Mm-hmm. That's a fact. But the real thing is that what he wants to do takes all the gravy away from the government bureaucrats who now get bribes for issuing permits to buy and so on and so forth. So the opposition is tremendous. And he has to break
government bureaucrats who are benefiting from the current system.
Right, right. That's why he's stressing the fight against corruption.
Now, Donald Trump says China's eating our lunch. What do you think?
I think Donald Trump Trump should eat his own lunch and be quiet. You know, if Trump were to be president, which I don't think will happen, he's going to go wherever the money is. He's going to make big deals with China in spite of all his talk now. And in negotiating, he thinks he's a big deal maker. The Chinese will run circles around him in negotiating. Mm-hmm.
The only thing people I think that the Chinese government will not be able to contend with in terms of negotiating is the Catholic Church, because they've been at it for 2,000 years.
Well, I know, but you know there's a kind of rapprochement with Pope Francis underway, who he gave an interview to the Italian correspondent in Beijing, Francesco Sisi, and the subject of the interview was, don't be afraid of rising China. So this pope is something new under the sun.
One last person I'd like to get your impression of, because you've had dealings with him, Henry Kissinger.
Mr. Kissinger is a very intelligent man whose intelligence is sometimes blocked by an enormous ego. That's what I'd say about him.
I've speculated, I wonder your reaction to this, that Mao and Chou En-lai got along with Henry Kissinger and Nixon, frankly, so well, because fundamentally they were all amoral pragmatists. What do you think of that?
Pragmatists, I think. On the Chinese side, I wouldn't say amoral. Mm-hmm. They had, in those days, they had a rather strict moral code. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Kissinger was amazed to find he's sitting down with Zhou Enlai and talking about philosophy. Mm-hmm. And Kissinger said, the Russians never talk philosophy.
We will be back with Sidney and Yulin Rittenberg in the Think Tank on KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back. Final segment, Sidney and Yulin Rittenberg. Let me plug the various books, by the way. There's a whole stack of them. Yulin's book is After the Bitter Comes the Sweet, which is really a personal history of her life. The principal story of Sidney's his life in China is The Man Who Stayed Behind, because he was. As an army officer, he stayed behind after the end of World War II in China and stayed there until roughly 1980. And a second book that we're going to get to in just a little bit, it's called Manage Your Mind. And essentially, my first understanding of the book was that it was sort of how do you deal with 16 years of solitary confinement. But really, I got a takeaway that this is sort of how to live a ethical and purposeful life, and I found it to be very inspiring. And we will get to that to conclude. But I wanted to pick up on the Henry Kissinger story. Yulin, you had an interesting encounter with tell us what you said in the break about what you said to Henry Kissinger.
Because we went to his office. We're talking about a business. He said it's very good. It's everybody's like him. So I said, probably you are the only one Chinese like you.
The only place where like people like you is China.
Only Chinese want to hate you.
Well, yeah. I remember in a visit that I played maybe 10 years ago to China on Chinese television. And it's all sort of playing in the background because it's mostly in Mandarin, of which I understand about three words. And all of a sudden, I realized I was hearing, and it didn't strike me, but I was understanding the words. And I was seeing, and this is like so many years later, I'm saying Nixon and Kissinger and the first trip and all. This is being played, 30 years later? And I'm just aware of the fact that I'm understanding the words now, because of course Nixon and Kissinger speak, well, Kissinger speaks sort of in English, but anyway, fascinating story.
Because he is the person who started American Chinese relationship.
Yep.
And that's why Chinese like him.
Yeah, he had the views here are probably a lot more mixed. They got intertwined with Vietnam
and
other kinds of issues. And I found that interesting.
That's true.
And particularly probably some of that Nixon, who spent his career as being an anti-communist and had certainly an unsavory end in this country. He probably would score higher in a public opinion poll in China than he would in the U.S. I want to talk about the recent book just published, Managing Your Mind. And as I said, I think to me it was much more about, or my big takeaway was sort of how to live an ethical and purposeful life. And that's kind of how you described the sort of the awfulness of being in solitary confinement. You had a number of principles that just stuck in my mind.
Yeah, I think that's right, Mike, because I found the problems that you have to deal with in solitary are the same problems you have to deal with walking down the streets of a busy American city.
Wow. Most people would have trouble. Elaborate on that.
No, it's true. You know, the problem of what's it all about? Is life worthwhile? What do you do with your life? Mm-hmm. How do you get along? The difference is in solitary, you have no diversion whatsoever. So you have to face those issues and deal with them. If it's true what some people say, that life has no meaning, life is tough and then you die, you know, uh-huh. Then what's the point in solitary? But you can't accept that. You have to, you know, my feeling was, I was born an American. I have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you don't give those things up yourself, nobody can ever take them totally away from you. It's up to you. The conditions may be very harsh.
Someone can impose a lot of constraints on that.
Yeah. They can narrow it down to very narrow, but they can never totally take it away unless you give up.
Mm-hmm. One of the principles that stuck in my mind in reading this is you state a core principle: be careful of the stories you tell yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's not just the objective situation, it's...
Right. Like the time that struck me was after a couple of years in solitary, I was sitting there one day thinking, even if I ever get out of this place, which I didn't know, I can never be a normal person again.
And that's a story you tell yourself.
That's a story I told myself, which depressed me. And then I realized that this was not reality. This was something I told myself. So poof, it was gone. The depression was gone.
So a lousy situation doesn't make you depressed. You tell yourself a story about it, you get depressed from the story.
That's right. It's your response. They control the stimulus, but you control the response to a certain extent.
I remember you talking about, for example, taking every opportunity. You're in solitary and the guards aren't even supposed to speak to you.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, there's a guard that's alone.
Yeah.
And you take every opportunity to engage.
Yeah, you take the opportunity, you tell him a little story about America that he appreciates, and then you feel really, really good, you know. It's like Shakespeare said, how far that little candle casts its light, mm-hmm. so shines a good deed in this naughty world. Mm-hmm. You're in a bad situation. Any little good thing that you can do lights up the whole scene.
And the guard, after all, didn't put you there. He's a guy doing a job.
Yeah, he's a kid from the villages.
Mm-hmm. Stick to your purpose.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think it's good for everyone to have a clear purpose in life. What business are you in? What are you really up to? And it's not easy to decide that, but the way you decide it is you look at where a person was yesterday, where he is today, and that gives you the trajectory that points toward his future, and that gives you his purpose, his real purpose.
I think a lot of people would have trouble understanding, okay, you're in a solitary confinement cell. How can you have a purpose?
Well, if you don't have a purpose, you're sunk, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, my purpose was to work on the U.S.-China relationship and to help people on both sides of the ocean understand each other better. And I saw no reason why I should give that up as long as I was alive. So that was a purpose.
How can you address that purpose in a cell?
Well, you tell the guard a little story. Mm-hmm. Also, I was very disciplined. I kept my cell squeaky clean. They would come around with the mop once a week. But I found that the way the mop works, each prisoner would dip the mop in his commode and then swab the floor and dip it back in the commode. And I didn't need the water from everybody's commode. So I took half of the piece of terry cloth they gave us for a towel mm-hmm. and mopped the floor with it. Next time the keeper came around with the mop, I say, I don't need it. It's clean. And he reached down, ran his hand across the floor. It was clean. Mm-hmm. So that's something good.
Wow. So what do you think, what do you see that we've got a minute or so to go? What do you see as the future of U.S.-China relations?
I think we're moving over a very bumpy road into a really close strategic partnership. Why? Because it's got to be that way. For the sake of the human race, all of the mortal issues that threaten us, like terrorism plus nuclear weapons, like climate change, like global financial issues, none of them can be solved if these two big countries don't work together. So I think in spite of all the contention and the quarrels and the competition, you will see us more and more going forward together to address these issues.
One final issue. I think I always hear this question. Well, there's a regime and we don't like aspects of it. There's a choice between isolate and engage.
Well, I don't think we really have that choice. We're not going to isolate China. Mm-hmm. We're not going to isolate 1.3 billion people. Mm-hmm. We tried that and it didn't work.
Thank you very much, Lynn and Sidney Rittenberg. It's been insightful. We are in the think tank, KTAR. See you next week.